From KPFK in Los Angeles, California, Valley Free Radio in Florence, and WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WNUC in Detroit, and BikeTalk.org worldwide, this is Bike Talk.
Bike Talk.
Welcome to Bike Talk. I'm Taylor Nichols.
I'm Nick Richard.
I'm Anne-Marie Drolet.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Anne-Marie.
Hey, Taylor. You're in Texas, Anne-Marie, right?
I am. I'm in Pipe Creek, Texas, 30 minutes from San Antonio. I'm at a campground.
Oh.
It's great. I came to watch the eclipse, but it was pretty cloudy. I only saw a tiny bit of it, but it got really dark, and that was cool. Kids riding bikes everywhere. There's e-bikers everywhere. The whole community.
Wow. Sounds great.
It's cool.
I saw the eclipse. That was something to see.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It was here in Los Angeles also, but the moon barely crested the sun, so it didn't really change things.
Yeah, not quite totality.
No. But I did ride 70 miles yesterday. Remember when the actors and the writers were on strike last year? There was a whole group called Bike to Strike, and we got together yesterday and did a 70-mile ride with 5,500 feet of climbing. It was a beautiful day, and it was a good ride.
I did a 30-mile ride on an e-bike. 30 miles on an e-bike can be exercise.
Totally. What kind of e-bike do you have?
Gravel bike. It's like an e-bike that's also a gravel bike. So we did so many different kinds. We did road and gravel and snow and trails. It was really good. So bikes are taking over, huh? Did you hear about Paris?
Thanks to you, I did.
I did just tell you, but it's in Forbes magazine from Carlton Reed, who does a spokesman podcast about how cyclists now officially outnumber drivers in Paris.
That's great. I've only been to Paris once, and it was like a couple of years ago, and it was already changing. There were already bikes everywhere. We didn't take a cab once. It was really beautiful.
I hope the U.S. follows suit sometime soon.
Well, I think right now we're shooting for the low-hanging fruit of like New York City or something.
Yeah, but if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
It must be true. So how about a legal moment right now?
I'm game.
Let's do it.
Last week, we ended the show reading a listener email from Christoph about his wife and cell phones and corporations.
Chris wrote that his wife was in a meeting where all of her colleagues admitted to taking online meetings from the car, including video and even reviewing documents on the phone. And Chris says it got him wondering whether a company could be sued if one of its employees caused a crash while using a mobile phone for work purposes. So is there a way to hold employers liable and in that way make them adopt policies for safe phone use while driving?
Yeah, because we know that distracted driving is a huge problem. So let's welcome Jim Pokras back on the show from Pokras and De Los Reyes. Hey, Jim.
Hi, how are you today?
We're doing great.
Thank you for having me again.
What's your take on this? I think the reason Christoph brings it up is because he's not trying to, you know, sue somebody necessarily. He's just trying to make the roads safer for people like us that are out there on our bikes.
My practice is I represent people that are injured as a result of the negligence of other people. And so in California, it's illegal to use a cell phone unless you're doing it in a hands-free manner. But it is legal to use a cell phone while you're driving. The immediate question that came up is whether or not employer would be responsible for, you know, one of their people if they're on the phone and they're distracted because they're on a cell phone and get into some type of a crash. And the answer from my standpoint as a lawyer is yes, they would be responsible for that. It is foreseeable that someone would be distracted if they're talking on a cell phone. And a lot of times you see people that are holding it up in their hands and they look at it or they're looking at it, reading a text or something like that while they're driving. Clearly, it distracts them from their attention on the road. And if they have an accident while they're doing that, not only the person that's driving, but the employer would have a responsibility because it's foreseeable that if they're doing business in a car that distracts them from driving, they could be in a crash.
What about cell phones and bikes?
It's not illegal in California to use a cell phone while you're riding. There are some states where it is illegal. In Chicago, it's illegal to have a cell phone and be riding on a bike. Arizona has an ordinance that doesn't allow the use of any kind of cellular phone or communication device while you're riding a bike. So check whatever state you're in to make sure as to whether or not it's legal or not legal.
I'm sure that there's not a lot of people who are going to be doing their business for their company while riding a bike, right?
If you're a courier, you absolutely have to be on your phone while you're biking. There's no way to avoid it. You can't really get around that. So you get really good at using your phone while biking.
I do a lot of business on the phone while I'm on my bike. That's like my office away from my office.
But then we're getting into the area where you're creating this false equivalence between doing it while you're driving and doing it while you're riding a bike.
I think the question was, is if you were doing some work for a company and they were talking to you while you were riding a bike, they would have some responsibility with regard to any kind of a crash or any kind of an injury that you may inflict on somebody else.
Jim, let's get back to the idea of if a person is driving a car and they're on just a business call, that's one thing. But if the employee is in a business meeting and they are on the phone and distracted because they're texting or looking at documents or whatever, and they cause a crash, then you say under the law that that employer could be responsible for damages in that crash.
That's exactly right. Okay. And you can see why. Okay. I mean, they should not be doing that because it's foreseeable that if they're doing that with somebody that's driving, that it could be distracting them from what they're supposed to be doing that's driving.
Right. In Chris's letter, he says he would hope that this could push large employers to at least adopt policies for safe phone use while driving. So even if the employer didn't know that their employees were doing this, you could assume that if they're a large employer, a certain percentage are doing what everybody does, which is use their phone while driving. If they don't have any policies about cell phone use while driving, then that could in itself just make them liable, I would think.
Right. That sounds good to me. Yeah.
And it sounds good to me as a lawyer too. So
because I'm not a lawyer.
What kind of policies do you think that we could push employers to adopt?
Well, I guess there'd be a policy that all their employees should not be conducting business, you know, while driving and on a cell phone or riding a bike. As long as they're on the cell phone and they get into a crash because of the fact that they're an employee of the employer, the employer would be responsible for damages as a result of that negligence of their employee.
Right. Well, Jim, how much do we owe you for this?
Well, this is what I do for a living. So you owe me nothing. Okay. It's just, I'm here to try to do justice and help people know the law.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Jim. And thanks for helping sponsor the show, Jim Pokras of Pokras and De Los Reyes.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, I am really glad Jim Pokras said it's legal to ride your bike and talk on the phone because I literally do it all the time.
Is it?
Yeah, no, he said it's legal. Yeah. It's just not wise.
Oh, okay.
And no one ever accused me of being wise.
It's a lot different riding a bike while being on the phone.
Right. And I leave the phone in my pocket. So I get my steps, you know, with my leg going up and down. I figure that counts as steps toward my 10,000 steps.
I pull my phone out and I just look at it. You know, I'm probably one of the bigger culprits, but I feel very competent in my biking and phone using skills. So I've had a lot of practice.
You know, what Jim didn't talk about, though, is whether it's legal to skateboard and talk on your phone. And so we have Tim Ward from Phoenix Skaters Who Bike on the show. Tim, welcome to Bike Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wait, tell us really quick. First of all, do you talk on the phone when you skateboard? But two, what is Skaters Who Bike?
I'm sure I have talked on the phone while I'm skateboarding before, but it's pretty noisy, so it wouldn't really be great to do so. And then also, I try not to talk on my phone when I'm biking because I don't want to disrupt my Strava. I don't want anything to come in between me and my Strava.
Exactly.
Well, but isn't using your Strava kind of like being on your phone?
It is, but I'm not staring at it. It's in my pocket.
Yeah, you're not texting it.
Right.
And Skaters Who Bike Ride is a group or an event or a club or a movement that I've started in Phoenix, Arizona to help my skateboarding friends drive less and ride bikes more. And, just basically having really fun skate days out on bikes. Phoenix is, like a lot of places, a very car-centric city, and myself included, but my skateboarding community that I'm a part of is very guilty of having six skaters drive six cars to one skate spot to meet up. And again, like I said, everything I say about anyone else, I'm directly talking about myself as well. So I'm a lifelong skateboarder. I've been skateboarding for 30 years and I've always liked riding bikes, but the last kind of 2 years I've gotten really, really into riding bikes and going to group rides and getting a little more familiar with like the actual bike community in Phoenix. And so I kind of just had the thought to combine the two because it was something I was starting to do personally. I was starting to just ride my bike to skate spots and skate parks a little bit more often. And so I decided to start an Instagram account and start where we meet up and go skate two or three or four or five skate spots using just our bikes.
Wow, that's a great idea.
And yeah, Anne-Marie, you saw them.
I did. Yeah, I was sitting on the LA River Path one day and I saw all these people bike by with skateboards. Yeah, it was super cool.
Yeah, that's great. That was our first LA ride, first of many, to kind of expand out of Phoenix and into a new city. So since I started doing this in November of 2022, so towards the end of 2022 was our first meetup, and we've been doing it monthly ever since here in Arizona. People from other cities have started to reach out about just kind of connecting with the idea and wanting to sort of bring it to their town in a way. And so generally when I get messages or comments like that, I enlist those commenters to be the volunteers to start one in their city. And so I think that this summer that's going to start happening a bit more. But what you saw was the first of hopefully many LA monthly Skaters Who Bike Ride meetups.
That's a great idea because I used to drive my car to ride my bike and I stopped doing that. I now ride to ride. And I love the idea of everybody getting on their bike and riding to some cool location down by the LA River or in somewhere in Phoenix in a parking garage. And then what do? Just hang out for a little while and skate and do tricks and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So I usually pick a meetup spot that's also a small skate park or a popular skate spot. We meet up there and then we'll ride, like I said, to, you know, anywhere between two or three or four or five other either skate spots or skate parks. And with some, you know, gas station drink stops along the way. And it's awesome. It's usually about 30 of us meet up and we skate and then bike to the next skate spot and then skate some more. And then we bike to the next skate spot and skate some more. And usually I'm filming most of this while it's happening. So then after each ride, I'll make a little edit for Instagram and put it up there. And it's been really fun.
Are gummies involved?
Gummies like the...
Are gummies involved with you right now, Taylor?
No, I'm not. I'm just curious.
I do these rides gummy free, but I'm sure there's people who bring some gummies to, you know, ease some of the anxiety of meeting some new people.
But it's a party.
Definitely a party, but it's noon. So it's not, we don't go into the night or anything like that.
I just couldn't get into skating. I was never any good at it.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm nearly 40 years old. I didn't know that I was still going to be a skateboarder at 40 years old, but I haven't wanted to stop yet. So
I think this group is really cool because it not only encourages people to ride bikes more, but also encourages people to skateboard more. Or maybe if they didn't have a huge community in the first place, you know, or maybe they felt too old. So it's kind of twofold.
For me, this is partially an outlet to explore bikes more because again, I've been really invested in the skate community for most of my life. So to me, this is a little bit of an effort to kind of learn about how like an organized bike ride works out. And what I have seen is it's gotten some of my friends who are more into bikes, who don't skateboard as much anymore, they've kind of gotten back on their boards a little bit more. And then I've also seen my friends who are really dedicated to skateboarding have been getting a little more invested in riding bikes after these rides. So it's kind of worked to sort of blend the two in a really nice way.
Yeah. Cool. So cool.
Can I shout out the ride that's happening in West LA on April 20th?
Absolutely.
There's going to be the second Skaters Who Bike Ride in LA. Basically, it's going to be a ride to the beach. And so the best way to kind of keep an eye on that is just through our Instagram at Skaters Who Bike Ride. So I've been talking to people in Florida, in Michigan, in Chicago, Portland, a bunch of cities where people are stoked on the idea, and they're interested in organizing their own ride. So it may be kind of a nationwide thing soon.
Well, Tim Ward of Phoenix Skaters Who Bike, thanks for coming on Bike Talk, man.
Thank you.
I know that bike lanes help businesses. And if you're listening to this show, you probably know that bike lanes help businesses also. But it's really funny. A lot of businesses and a lot of other people don't understand the benefit of bike lanes. So today we have on the show Adam Rogers, who's a senior correspondent at Business Insider. And he did a deep dive into all of the surveys about bike lanes. I mean, Adam, I'll let you talk about it, but going back 20, 30 years at least, I think. Adam Rogers, welcome to Bike Talk.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
You wrote this article, Bike Lanes Are Good for Business. Why is that true?
Every time I would read about resistance to the construction of a protected bike lane. And in my head, I know there's a lot of tiers of those, but in my head, that's like, you know, a curbed or bollarded separate space on a street just for bikes or, you know, scooters or, you know, wheel vehicles right. that aren't cars. And to me, as somebody who has really spent a lot of time thinking about cities and living in cities and reading and writing about cities, that seems like a no-brainer net good for all the reasons that your show always talks about, right? For, you know, climate reasons and health reasons and urban planning reasons and walkability, bikeability reasons and all this other good stuff. And every time it would happen, the resistance to constructing the lane would pretty much come from neighbors, people who lived right close to it, and the businesses that the bike lane was adjacent to, primarily because these kind of, again, in my head, the high level protected bike lane takes away street parking. And so the businesses, business owners would be afraid that because of that parking, because of a change in the street front, that they would lose business. And they were resistant. And these are, you know, these retailers, restaurateurs, bar owners, shop owners are operating on really thin margins. And that's only gotten more frightening for them post-pandemic, right. As number of walking people changes, you know, business districts downtown have changed. But I would say every time that would happen, I would post on social media or I would say to friends or I would go on group chats, does anybody have any actual study, research that has shown that a bike lane, that installation of a bike lane hurts adjacent or nearby businesses? And nobody, there would never be any. Nobody would ever, you know, send me anything or point me to anything.
You know, just really quick, what metrics were you looking at that say whether bike lanes help or don't help a certain area?
Back then, I was still kind of like farting around. I don't know. Like I was just trying to get my head around the idea, thinking like, well, you know, in the economics of city, do businesses fail? Do they make less money after the bike lane goes in than before that? Are there more bankruptcies? Are there more empty shops? Do the number of customers coming in change? And I started to find some. So there was some research in Australia that said when they took away parking spaces on a shopping street in like Adelaide, I think, because you could actually fit more bikes to park in the same space, that there were more customers. That was the only one that I had found at that point. I wasn't looking really, I wasn't making it. It hadn't become a profession yet. Like I hadn't been trying to do it for work.
Right.
And finally, I live in the California Bay Area. I live in Berkeley. And there was a big fight in town about putting in a protected bike lane along a shopping street that I frequent a lot. And it's within biking distance of my house. And it's a beautiful, it's Berkeley, man. It's a like a fantastic local high street. It's got a great butcher shop and a fishmonger and a pizza place and a sushi place and a, you know, a grocery store with the best California produce. I'm like, people should bike there, you know? Right. And it was a huge fight. And finally after years of fighting, it went down in flames. And I said to myself and to my editor, okay, look, I got to find out if there's any actual data to back up the assertion that the people who lived there and the people who worked there were making, which is this will destroy our wonderful, beautiful Berkeley shopping street.
Right.
So I said to my boss, who was kind of, he was like, seems pretty localized. Seems like not a, you know, I mean, whatever. He's doing what editors are supposed to do, which is make sure that you have something good to hold on to. And I finally said, okay, I tell you what, I'm going to read all of it. I'm going to go find all of the studies and I will read all of them, thinking in my head, because my training is primarily as a science reporter, covered a lot of stuff, but I started out covering science, thinking of the form called a meta-analysis. When there's been a lot of research in a given field, another researcher comes in, reads as much of that as they can, gathers all that data, and then kind of aggregates it and tries to get, well, what's the overall takeaway? Because no one scientific study of anything is ever enough to really know, well, you got it right. So I started reading what was there, and then you go to the citations for those and you read what they're citing, and you start to read every cross citation that you can find. And that's, so I finally assembled what I think is a pretty canonical collection of going back to about the 80s.
Wow.
It was about 30 papers and reports and studies. So I didn't confine myself to just journal articles and peer-reviewed publications, but also like government reports, Department of Transportation kind of reports.
Right.
And so I got all 30 studies and I went to go read them.
What was the outcome of these 30 studies?
So the overall outcome, and this is what I said in the article, was often the installation of a bike lane in a downtown shopping area, if it has a significant effect, because it doesn't always, sometimes it doesn't make a difference at all. Right. And if it does, that effect is positive. The size of that positive effect varied from city to city, and who it was most positive for is a thing inside the data that you have to kind of unpack and unweave the warp and weft of the data to try to understand who it is. But the overwhelming takeaway was, if it does anything, it's going to help.
Right.
These are good things. And in some places, in some of these studies, the amount that it helped was enormous. There was a Seattle one that was like a 400% increase in revenue. And then in other places, it's not that big an effect. Plus, and this is where I get super nerdy about it, there are methodological issues that are only now being kind of understood by the people who study cities and the economics of cities and biking and transportation, to try to make these studies convincing, not just to the opposition, if you want to put a bike lane, but convincing to all of us, to make it so that you and I could actually agree, you know, honestly and with integrity and authentically, that like, no, these actually help. And they do. The best studies are the ones that show the most effect, the most positive effect.
Because one of the things you talk about is there are two sorts of studies. There's a survey study, but also there is financial information as a metric.
Right.
And I wonder if you could explain that.
You do a survey. You go to the shopkeepers and say, hey, would you be opposed to a bike lane? Yes or no? And why is that? And how many people do you think ride a bike to your business versus take a bus versus walk versus drive? And then you go to the people who are shopping on the street and you say, how'd you get here today? And how often do you come here? And if you bike here, how much do you spend on average when you get here? You know, it's a quantitative survey study. And much of the work that I found were these surveys out of, you know, the whatever it was, 30, 35 papers.
Like, I think as bicycle advocates, we've all filled out those surveys
exactly.
That are online, or, you know, someone on the street or something like that.
Sure. But you immediately can hear what the potential criticism of those kinds of studies would be. Say, well, first of all, who's most likely to answer the survey? If you cycled there and somebody says, I'm doing a study, if somebody, you know, walks up to you with their bike and they're wearing their cycling shorts and they've got their helmet under their arm and they say, I'm doing a study about biking to the high street. You're like, great, cool.
Right.
You know, how many derailleurs do you have? You can tell I'm not an avid cyclist, but like, you know, you're more likely to do that study than somebody who drove their F-150 there that day.
Right.
And more importantly, for these kind of things, shopkeepers especially wildly overestimate how many people drive to their shop, to their restaurant, to their bar, to their store, and wildly underestimate time and time again in survey after survey how many people get there by other means. And you can understand why that would be. It makes sense. Somebody who is late for their reservation because they couldn't find a parking space is going to come in angry and complaining. Somebody who came in, who rode their bikes and, you know, locked it up on the sign outside and breezed right in, they didn't say anything to you, and so you have no idea how they got there. And if you are a person who's living and dying by this shop that you own, any kind of change, anything that's going to affect, like, oh, I see somebody park in front and come right in, I want them to be able to park there. I want people who deliver the stuff to my store to be able to park there because I'm in New York and they forgot to build alleys in New York.
Right.
I sell a thing that's heavy, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
I sell paint. Nobody's going to ride their bike here. You know, maybe they will, but you think that. So, you know, when asked to do a survey, different kinds of people are more incentivized to answer the survey. So there's those sorts of issues. People lie, they misremember, they get stuff wrong, they answer out of their personal self-interest. So I said, and this is a thing you're allowed to do in a meta-analysis, I said, I'm going to not talk about those. The ones that do surveys, I'm not going to incorporate into this paper, because there are 7 very, very good reports, research papers, that use financial data, that don't rely on surveys, but that use data from state taxes, data from the census. There's a Standard & Poor's proprietary data set of every business in the country where they fill out what kind of business they are and what their revenues have been. There's actual raw information about how a business did. And then you start to get into the methodological issues. All right, so we're going to look at it. This one's obvious. We'll look at it before the bike lane and after the bike lane. Duh, right? Okay, but that's a study without a control. You can ask yourself, well, what would happen if they didn't put the bike lane in? There's no way to know that because they put the bike lane in. So you have to compare it to a comparable shopping street, let's say in the same city, half a mile away. Right. Now you have a control group and an experimental group. And then you could say, well, wait a minute, what if the economy tanked while this was all happening, as it did in the last 5 years for retail? Right. So you have to compare it in addition to the comparable street. You also compare it to the city overall or the borough overall, the neighborhood overall. Now you have a methodology that's very difficult. There's a ton of data to compare. It's hard to do, takes a long time, but you have one that provides you with some very convincing results when you do it right. So those are the, you know, those half dozen studies. Each of the papers that I looked at, the reports I looked at, often they looked at multiple neighborhoods in one place. Like there's a big one out of New York that looks at more than one neighborhood, more than one shopping street or area in a bunch of different boroughs, for example. Right. So you end up with 15 different, you know, bike lane, yes or no bike lane kind of comparisons.
Right.
And that became, you know, the convincing centerpiece, the prime cut of information.
Right, of the article. So you've taken all the subjective stuff out. You're just left with, what are the facts, ma'am?
Yeah, that was the idea.
I totally get that owners overestimate the amount of people that drive. And that makes me think, when you ride your bike to a store, let them know you rode your bike. Let them say, hey, it was so great to get here on my bike, so that they can start to hear people using that. Because you're right, every time a bike lane is proposed, there is huge backlash, even in neighborhood streets.
Yeah. And I want to be sympathetic to that. I understand why you would be concerned, you know, especially because we've built our cities in this country for the last going on 100 years, but really call it, you know, since the post-war era, we've built them where mobility demands using a car.
Right.
If you're a person who has any sorts of limits on your mobility, when somebody says to you, it's going to be even a fraction of a percentage harder to get around in that car, that has real impact on you. That impacts your life. That impacts your day. That impacts your time. It impacts how you get your stuff. You know, that's real. Right. And so I feel like, you know, you have to be sensitive to that at the same time as you can say, but I'm going to tell you, like, it won't be as bad as you think. You'll like it better. And if you're for the retail side, for these businesses that, as I say, are really under huge pressure right now in most downtown areas and a lot of neighborhoods in the United States, to say to them, like, this is going to be good.
Right.
This is going to be good.
You do say in the article that there are some losers. There's a lot of winners, but there are some losers when bike lanes go in. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So in some places, for example, bars and restaurants do a lot better.
Right.
But, you know, dry goods kind of retail does
furniture
a little bit
stores,
worse for a furniture store, or but different kinds of those. So, you know, there's no reason, like if you've gone to any retail space in the United States in the last couple of years to see what has changed on a high street since the most intense years of COVID, the shops that remain solidly are like places where people have to go there for the service, but don't acquire any stuff. So a tattoo parlor, or a barbershop, or a massage parlor, or a gym, those places are doing okay.
Right, a coffee shop, right.
Yeah. Coffee shop's another good example. Bars and restaurants had a little more trouble because they have to employ more people and pay them differently. But a place like, I always think of them as like a fancy tchotchke store, a place where you go and like buy a nice little gift for somebody, a little pot, a plant, or a, you know, a pretty framed portrait. Those have had a lot of trouble, partially because of the change in who goes downtown to do shopping, partially because their whole supply chains have gotten messed up, partially because you have to, you know, you carry stuff, because online retail has totally upended the retail business in real life, the brick and mortar retail.
So it's not bike's fault, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, in that case, the bikes didn't do it, but they suffered for it, because those places now don't want a bike lane. They screw things up, you know, any further. So if you're, as you say, if you're a furniture store, well, look, you know, how many people buy furniture that when they go in immediately, they walk in, they're looking for a couch, they see one, they don't walk out with that couch. They walk in, they see the couch and they say, oh, I'm coming back for that. And then they send the truck or whatever. So, you know, it's not completely clear why that would be, but if you go in and you're going to buy, you know, 10 gallons of paint, you probably drove there. You want, it's good. Those places, it's good if they have a parking lot, you know, because you can pull right in. But place like that, on a street that then gets a bike lane, they didn't have a parking lot, then looks up and says, oh, well, that, you know, that's really going to cost us. Even if right across the street, now a little ramen shop can open where it wasn't feasible for them before, and now they can.
Right.
You know, so even if the overall street kind of does better after they finish construction a year later, maybe a couple of those businesses will be doing worse. And then the question is, well, how do you address those needs while you put the bike lane in?
Good. Yeah, that was my next question. A few losers can't keep us from moving forward as a society.
There's a few ways you can think about that, I think. One of them is, and a lot of people who I talked to for the article said this to me, if you're a Department of Transportation, if you're a city, if you're a city government, you got to own up and be very clear what your priorities are. You can go to a person who's like, yeah, you're in the tax base, and yeah, you're a person who votes for your city council person, but in this city right now, we care about increasing multimodal mobility. We care about the tax base, but we also care about our climate footprint. We also care about making sure that people move downtown and can get the stuff they need, or they move toward closer to the shopping street, which is why we're building that 501 apartment building down right. The street. Also, you know, you can say, here's our priorities. And you can say, like, I'm really sorry, but we have citywide priorities that are bigger than this one store where I'm standing right now. That's a hard thing to do.
Sure.
You can change some tax incentives and other business structures in the city to say, okay, if you suffer from this bike lane, we're going to cover you. We got you covered. You know, give them some money. If you're a retailer, you're on a street where we put a bike lane in, you don't have to pay as much tax. All these laws and rules are invented. We imagine right. them. We change them, right. make them up, change them. There's right. some.
Or help them move to a bigger street where there are more large commercial stores or yes. something like that too.
Different
right?
place. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are economic and political things that can change, you know, to make this process easier as it becomes a priority in many cities.
Right. Well, I love the fact that you're a business reporter and not a biking reporter, because coming at it from a nuts and bolts vantage point of bike lanes are good for business is really great ammunition for bicycle advocates and people who stand up at community meetings to make their point heard about why our downtown areas need to change.
We do this thing in urbanism and advocacy so often. And I write a lot about cities, and I really care about housing. You know, it was one of my big right. issues, and I've written a lot about it. Where, you know, where we say, where the advocates will say, and I've written this too, we say, like, we need denser housing in cities because it's better for climate, and because it's better for, it addresses issues of inequality and generational wealth. It addresses systemic racism issues. It makes the city a more vibrant place. A housing advocate will say all of those things. And if you're the person who lives in the house that's about to have an apartment building next door to you, you think in your brain, you think, all well and good, but I'm going to have an apartment building looking down on my backyard now. I can understand why if you've lived in a place for 20 years, you don't want it to change like that. And I think in some senses, many of the arguments that are just rock solid about why you want more cycling in a city and more walking and more scooters and whatever, just rock solid arguments about climate and about health and about mental health and about kind of the lovability of a neighborhood. All those arguments are really, really good, but they do get weighed against a local business person saying, I'm going to go out of business. I won't be here to pay taxes in the city. This neighborhood won't have a dry cleaner anymore
right.
because of this. You know, those are real. That's real. And you want to be able to say, I didn't know if I was going to be able to when I started reading these articles. You want to be able to say, no, that's not, it won't happen. Or it won't happen the way that you're saying it will. Right. That's going to be good too. This helps that too. Right. We're all on the same team here. One difficulty of this, I'm going on a rant, I apologize, but it is that data doesn't really change their minds. And we see this time right. and again in the last right. few years, certainly in the United right. States.
That's New York. That's not LA. That's Amsterdam. That's mm-hmm. not the United States.
For sure. And so now this is information that is less useful perhaps to convincing the local framing shop owner to come around than it is to take to a city council meeting and say, I hear what the local framing shop owner is saying, but it's just not what the data shows.
Right.
You know, right. and it becomes a thing that the decision makers, the policy makers can then, you know,
weigh,
take some power from.
Right. Yeah. One other data point that you bring up is every new mile of bike lane increases the numbers of bikes on the street by 1%.
Isn't that
I think
wild?
That's great. I love that. Adam Rogers from Business Insider, it was in the March 7th issue. Magazine is online, correct?
Yep, 24/7. All you got to do is click.
Thank you very much for all the deep diving that you did into this topic. I hope our listeners take it and move it forward.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's a terrific topic. I appreciate your time.
Parking dictates so much, and I think it's way more political than people think. You know, people always state it as a reason for not wanting to put in bike lanes because they'll lose parking spots. But, you know, once again, as we always talk about, a landscape catering mainly or only to cars is hostile to everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. It happens so often. Business owners will fight road diets on the grounds that people are not going to come to their business because they can't park right in front or they don't have enough parking. And that's just not the case.
One of the great things about Adam's article that I really loved, and also the interview, is that it gave me some information to fight back with. We have talked on the show before about a street right near where I live, where we are trying to calm the traffic. And the city council finally has voted to implement some of these traffic calming measures. And one of the guys who's running for city council of West Hollywood, California, wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper complaining about how dumb of an idea it was. So I took the information I got from Adam and I answered his letter. This is my letter. There is an abundance of empirical data that proves traffic calming and safe street infrastructure is good for business and raises property values of housing near the areas. Our quality of life is improved when we can walk and bike safely in our own neighborhoods. Traffic is not like water, always finding the path of least resistance. Traffic evaporation and induced demand are real phenomenon. And if these are unfamiliar terms, it's up to you, the reader, and the civic leaders to help us all understand that more people and less cars leads to a quieter, cleaner, and safer street for everyone. So take that, you guy who's running for city council.
Yeah, Taylor.
I just like that analogy because people do often say traffic is like water. If we block it off on one street, it's just going to go on to this other street. And that's not necessarily the case. Human beings make decisions every time they choose to run an errand. And if it's not easy or safe to drive a car, they won't do it. Or if it's not easy or safe to ride a bike, they won't do it. They will choose the mode of transportation that best suits their needs.
I know that sounds like water to me.
Not if you can't get there easily in a car, then you take the bus because the bus is rapid and direct, or you ride your bike because you're only going a mile. The next interview is you, Anne-Marie, right? You and Julie did that.
We did. Yeah, we interviewed Allison Griswold, who wrote about why Lyft is running from bike share. And we talked about our current resistance against Lyft taking over bike share in LA.
Well, that's something we've been talking on the show also about.
Here it is.
Recently, Metro proposed to have Lyft run LA's bike share. After strong opposition from unions and cyclists, Metro backed down and BTS will continue to run LA bike share. Allison Griswold will discuss her article, Why is Lyft Running from Bike Share? With Anne-Marie Drolet, a bike mechanic with Bicycle Transit Systems. Anne-Marie speaks for herself and does not represent her employer, Bicycle Transit Systems.
I've actually referenced this article quite a bit.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. I wrote it for my newsletter and then Slate just cross-published it.
I mean, it's a great article because I've been involved in a fight with my union and my company to not let Lyft take over. So I was like, oh my God, we're interviewing the person that I've been referencing so much. So yeah, I was like, I guess I see this more as like a conversation because I'm just like, oh my God, can we talk about these things?
Yeah, I mean, go for it. You're on the ground, so I'm really curious what your experience is, right? I have much more of the mile high view. I've been covering the space for a long time. I've sort of seen companies pull the same playbook in different situations, but by no means am I a person who's on the ground in the meetings, right?
Yeah.
With the issue with Lyft, I was really like, when you started talking about the CEO's pay and his bonuses, I was getting fired up. I was like, what the? Because you're going to cut bikes to be productive.
Yeah. I will say I'm often sympathetic to both sides. I think there's our ideal world that we'd all love to live in, that all of these systems are well-funded by their local or regional transit authorities. They get their full wish list. They have great labor protocols. Mm-hmm. The rides are affordable. Everyone can sort of hop on, hop off. And then there's the world we often do live in, where government funding is hard to come by. Public transit programs are consistently facing cuts and being, you know, sacrificed at legislatures as part of political battles. And so because of that, I do see the place for private operators, but I wish we lived in that first world, not the second.
Yeah. Well, and like with my company is a private operator, but I think they do a great job, you know, and you could definitely say I'm biased, but like we have a unionized workforce and we work well together. You know, Lyft said they would recognize our union, which doesn't really mean much. It means they could hire one person from our union and say, look, we recognize your union, you know, so you can do it in a way that's not actually very helpful. So
and what is Lyft's dominant model? Do they use in-house people or do they use contractors for most of their ride-offs?
They hire a subcontractor. A lot of their bike shares are run by Motivate or by Shift.
And Motivate employs people or it hires them as gig workers?
Motivate hires people and they're employees and they do hire a lot of seasonals also. Mm-hmm. Depending on which city they're in, they may or may not be in the union. Mm-hmm. Yeah, workers that I've talked to who work with Shift, which is I think like 25% of the Shift's workforce is unionized. They sound like they're really hard to bargain with. They don't really want to budge on raises, which is very basic and very crucial to keep up with cost of living, of course. Shift, who is supposed to be our, you know, new subcontractor, if Lyft did take over, it sounds like they wouldn't be a great company to work for in terms of union work.
One thing that struck me about hearing you talk about your bike share earlier was how you said that bikes are the only thing we do. And so everything we do is focused on, you know, making the system the best bike share system it can be. And that's obviously a noted contrast with Lyft's approach. As we know, it's a ride-hail firm and bikes has always been sort of a secondary offering tacked on since they acquired it. And you know, the CEO has said that they want to use bikes as an entry point into the broader Lyft ecosystem. You know, it's great if people take bikes, but the goal is ultimately to get them into ride-hail as customers.
Yeah, and you say it really well that they said the quiet part loud. You know, they admitted what their goals are. It's really easy to find information on that. They're not really being secretive about it. They force people to download the app if they want to check out a bike. They can't just use a transit app. So they have to download the Lyft app if they want to rent a bike, which
I would caution that this article is almost a year old. I don't want to make any claims about the status of the technology. But that certainly was true at the time.
If the goal is to get people to use public transit and micromobility, you should be able to show them where they can do that, not try to get them to take a ride share.
It's one thing to talk about the pursuit of seamless multimodal travel. It's another thing to do it. And doing it in earnest, you would think, would mean integrating your mode with all the other modes as much as possible. Bike share is one of those things that's really market by market, and it often comes down to the specific city. So it's not necessarily the same everywhere. Like even with Lyft, there's huge contractual differences between the way City Bike is run versus Boston's program versus San Francisco. It's really quite variable. And often that's just based on how the negotiations go at the local level. So in that sense, Anne-Marie, I was really curious, were you taken by surprise that the board recommended going with Lyft?
I was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like it wasn't clear to me where dissatisfaction with the existing contract was coming from?
The main thing that came up again and again was the cost. Lyft quoted a cost that was about half as much as what Bicycle Transit Systems did. But then I looked into their budget proposal and they didn't fill out most of the numbers. Like they say they care about equity. And then I looked at their equity section and there was no money allotted to it. I was like, I don't understand why they would even look at this.
Do you feel like you were sort of punished for being too honest in your projections?
Yeah, I feel like the company was, because I didn't write the proposal. I'm just a mechanic. But yeah, it seems like they were punished because they did the assignment. You know what I mean? Like, they allotted millions of dollars for an adaptive bike program and a bike library, which is huge if you're talking about, again, equity, which Lyft claims to care about. But then we get punished because that costs extra. I was like, I don't understand what they want. Lyft was also able to negotiate a cap to the amount of money they could be charged for penalties if they didn't meet certain service level agreements, which we weren't able to negotiate. So that means that even if they're underperforming, they wouldn't get penalized as much. So what's the motivation to perform well?
I have heard this in other markets, that the essentially financial incentives to hold Lyft to account are not always robust enough to mean anything. But it's very interesting that you say BTS wasn't able to negotiate equivalent incentives. It really just sounds like two separate conversations happening about the same contract. Do you get the sense that there was perhaps a large behind the scenes lobbying effort or something else at play?
That is what it felt like. It seemed like they'd been chatting them up for years. which felt really unfair.
What would your dream bike share contract for LA look like?
I would want BTS to continue running it. And I feel like that one does show that you can have a public-private partnership and it can still work. But we would need more funding from the city. Fares don't really pay for much. Ideally, it would just be free. And I know that as a challenge to actually make happen. But yeah, I think if it was truly subsidized, that would be amazing. That would be so helpful if they took money away from highway widening and projects geared towards putting more cars on the road and put that towards bike share. That would be truly amazing. And it would get people to ride more forms of public transit, because they all ideally link together. And we would have more bike shares in more places and more people would be able to ride it.
Yeah.
That's hard to do, to put that on a city to say, you need to give us more money.
This is where the discussion always gets a little complicated, because I do think one of the values that Silicon Valley and private companies offer in that respect is they are the people that are willing to invest a bunch of money and time in a new concept in a place that's never had it before. Like, if you just think of it on a practical level, a city that's never had bike share probably doesn't have the money to just buy 1,000 bikes and install a bunch of docking stations and get that market going. I think there is this element that we owe to startups that they're willing to literally start up a new service that may or may not work. With something like bike share, ideally you hope it becomes essentially part of public transit, and at some point that crosses over into a model that's just not as compatible with a company that wants to recoup its initial investment and then turn a profit.
There's always another motive in a situation like that. It's not just we care about bike share. It's also we care about making money, making a profit.
You know, here in London, a lot of the bike initiatives, not bike share per se, but a lot of other ancillary bike services are run and funded out of the local boroughs, which get some funding from the city and some from taxes that you pay as a local resident. Anyway, they're all coming up on financial hard times. They don't want to have to cut their services, but they just don't have the money to sustain them. But also they don't want to give them over to the private sector. And I think it's just a tough reality. Like, what do you do in that situation?
Northampton Bikes, we have these different cities right all around us, and it's part of this bike share transit system. So you have these different cities that have to earmark funding in advance for the year and then reevaluate. Do you see that as an avenue to help cities become more sustainable running their own bike share program?
Yeah, I feel like at least 3 years is needed just to compare it to a restaurant. You won't necessarily see the most amazing progress in the first year, which wouldn't necessarily be the fault of the operator.
It is like a restaurant in that it's sort of a classic low margin business, and mm-hmm. more people attracts more people, right? If your restaurant is popular, everyone wants to eat there. If people are riding your bike share, more people are going to ride it because feel safer and they see people doing it and it occurs to them it's an option and like lots of other sociological effects. I think most providers would probably have a hard time with a one-year agreement. Like I think we're often with these contracts when we're thinking of how can we structure them in a way that's fair to both sides, but keeps the goal in the right direction. A lot of times it's about like, how do we increase transparency? How do we make mm-hmm. sure our operator is reporting and sharing the data and, you know, evaluating mm-hmm. and measuring the things that we care about and we want evaluated? How do we make sure that they are really committing to, you know, inclusivity programs and that they're not just checking it in sort of a tokenized way? Mm-hmm. And with, you know, non-compliance penalties, how do we structure penalties like that in a way that are both reasonable and not going to unfairly penalize an operator that's like just getting started and having to overcome a bunch of challenges, mm-hmm. but also that's just could be considered a cost of doing business, right? That they don't care about.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You have to be able to hold companies accountable in some way. And yeah, I think transparency is a huge thing. And also just allowing community input and decision making is super important.
When you got all the comments about the BTS contract, I wanted to ask, do you have a sense of who those were coming from primarily? Like, were they cyclists who used the program? Were they workers? Who was the public that was speaking up?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it was the cycling community. It was also other unions. I was able to work with DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and they mm-hmm. have a transit campaign they're working on. So they've also been able to reach out to just people who care about workers and public transit being successful. Yeah, it was a combination of just people in the community, people who use the system, people who care about workers, people who care about public transit and climate justice, because that's a huge part.
Sure. Do you think it will ultimately change things?
I hope so. I'm optimistic. This has demonstrated that the public is invested and they do care. People are super on board with keeping bike share, keeping it as what should be, you know, a public good, and hopefully making it even better, making it, you know, a part of mobility justice, you know, allowing people to get where they need to go and in an equitable way.
I do feel like an interesting avenue that hasn't really been explored is we're seeing loads of incentives at the state level for people to purchase e-bikes in a number of states and cities. And I do sometimes wonder what the pathway would be to getting a similar incentive funding stream, but into shared bike programs. Because ultimately the goal is just to get more bikes and e-bikes into use, right? It's to get people out of cars and onto cleaner, more accessible modes of transportation. I think because it's the US and we tend to think about private ownership first and foremost, perhaps the natural way to structure that funding is in terms of a rebate to buy your own device. But I do think there's a question about what it would take for that money to instead be allocated into public transit.
Well, Allison and Anne-Marie, you both have given me a lot to think about.
Yeah, this has been a great conversation. I've had a lot of fun. Thanks, Allie.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's so great to have someone from Metro Bike Share that can do these interviews, Anne-Marie.
It's the Inside Scoop with Anne-Marie.
It's like you're embedded.
Someone on the inside.
I don't know about LA, but in New York City, I've heard people use bike share instead of having a bike. Well, that might be for storage reasons.
Storage, maintenance, theft.
There you go. So here we are at the end of the show. Thanks to Jim Pokras. Thanks to Tim Ward and our guests, Adam Rogers and Allison Griswold.
And remember, if there's something out there where people are saying bike lanes are bad or scary, tell them that you know different, because bike lanes are good for business. And you learn that on Bike Talk. Like us on social media. Subscribe. Tell your friends. Post it on Instagram or whatever. It really helps. We get a lot of feedback from the listeners and we really appreciate that.
How about a bike quote?
Oh, snap.
Yeah, I've got a quote. No hour of life is wasted when it's spent on two wheels.
Or as George Orwell said, two wheels good, four wheels bad.
But then there's skateboards.
And on that note, ride safe, everybody.
Hi, this is Stacy with a Bike Thought. Bike lanes are good for business, but don't just take it from us here at Bike Talk. Listen to this business owner.
My name is Morris Collins. I live in on Edgewood Boulevard in Providence, and I work on South Water Street. Bike lane is good for business. We've been doing business in this neighborhood for 25 years, and we urge you to consider the bike lane not only as a lane of traffic, but also in the way to transform the neighborhood, making it safer and more inviting to the kind of clientele we ultimately want and need to survive. One example, for 20 years, water fire was a loss for us. Surprising, but true. We tried everything we could think of to get some of those thousands of people down to visit us, but nothing worked. The way was inhospitable and dangerous. Since the arrival of the bike lane, that has changed completely. It has become one of our best shifts. One of our best people now works it, and we hired an extra staffer to handle the level of business. The clientele we now get at this hour are new to us. They're older. They buy our more expensive products, tip our staff well, and they're kind to them. They're both a quantitative and qualitative improvement to our business. So we ask you to consider the many positive effects the bike lane has had in helping our neighborhood to become more than a speedway to the highway. Instead of what's best for people who want to leave our city as quickly as possible, please encourage those of us who live here and those who want to stay with us and maybe spend some money while they do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mara.
That was Morris Collins, age 59, and owner of the Wild Colonial Tavern on Water Street in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you, Morris, for speaking the truth about bike lanes. This episode of Bike Talk is sponsored by the law offices of Pocras and De Los Reyes, with offices in Los Angeles and Bakersfield and serving all of Southern California.
And that was Bike Talk. If you have a story, a tip, or a topic, head over to biketalk.org and send us a message. Talk again next week.
Push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get your heart started. Push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Get on your bike, sit on the seat, push your feet on the pedal, and ride it all around, get on your bike, sit on the seat, push your feet on the pedal, and ride it all around. Yourself a bike.